Here's a few quick notes about the show. Southern Girl Crime Stories is a podcast focused mostly on lesser-known true crime cases that range from murders, missing persons, cold cases, soft cases, and more. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, locations of murders, and more. Taylor Ashley Wright was born on April 23, 1984, and grew up in South Carolina. Those who knew Taylor said she was a very compassionate, outgoing, charismatic, and funny individual. At some point, she married Jeff Wright, and they had a son together. However, by 2017, 33-year-old Taylor, who was now living in Pensacola, Florida, was in the middle of a divorce and custody battle with Jeff and was working as a private investigator. Before moving to Pensacola, she worked as a police officer in Jacksonville from 2008 to 2009 and then again from 2012 to 2013. While in Pensacola, she met Ashley Britt MacArthur, a former crime scene investigator, and the two women became very close friends. She also met Cassandra Waller online, and the two began dating and eventually moved in together. On September 8, 2017, Taylor withdrew $34,000 from her and Jeff's joint account. Afterward, she met up with Ashley and entrusted her with the money until her divorce was final. She then mysteriously vanished. By September 14th, when Cassandra had not heard from Taylor in several days, she reported her missing. Investigators searched her apartment, but there was nothing missing. All her personal belongings were still there, and her car was parked outside. Investigators began thinking she might have just gone out of town after Cassandra received a text from Taylor's phone saying she needed to get away for a few days. There were also multiple people who came forward and reported seeing her after she went missing. This goes to show you how inaccurate witness sightings are because, as you'll see in the end, they never saw her. Her family knew she was not the type of person to just up and leave and began fearing the worst. Plus, Cassandra was used to Taylor's text messages, and the last text she received from her felt off. When they first questioned Ashley, she told them that Jeff was aggressive and had been violent with Taylor leading up to the divorce. This put Jeff at the top of the suspect list, but he was quickly ruled out because he was hundreds of miles away out of town on the day she disappeared. She also said that after giving Taylor the money, she left with it in a duffel bag, and she never saw her again. Investigators decided to question Ashley's boyfriend, and they were shocked at the stuff he told them. Here's a clip of that interview.
How well do you trust Ashley?
I don't trust her at all.
You don't trust her with your freedom?
No, hell no. I catch her in too many lies.
Your feelings on all this missing person and her talking to you, what's your thoughts?
There's more to the story. I don't know. She's point blank said they are not going to find her. She took that money and left.
What do you think about that?
Don't make no sense.
Since she was possibly the last person to see Taylor, this immediately made her a person of interest. Suspicions began to rise even further when investigators found that she had deposited the $34,000 cashier's check in Taylor's name to her own bank account. She then took the money out and placed it in a safe deposit box. However, they noticed that some of that money ended back up in Ashley's bank account. During a second interview, Ashley tells them that after giving Taylor the money, they went horseback riding in East Milton, 20 miles away from Pensacola. They then went their separate ways after arriving back at Ashley's home. When they questioned Ashley about the money, she said that Taylor was drawing large amounts of money out and hiding it until her divorce was final. As they continued investigating Ashley, they would stumble on multiple things that would break the case wide open. First, Ashley said that she went to a wedding in Alabama, but they also discovered that Taylor's phone was pinging from that same location, even though they weren't together. So why was Taylor's phone with Ashley? They also discovered that they weren't in East Milton at the time Ashley said they were. They had actually first gone in the opposite direction to Ashley's family's farm. When confronted with this, Ashley acknowledged they had gone by the farm. When asked why, she said that Taylor needed to get some kind of lockbox she had left there. Here's the moment Ashley is confronted with that information.
Planning all the phone calls that you and Taylor were making that day. There are some discrepancies in what you have told us.
Okay.
We know that you didn't go to Milton when you said you went to Milton.
We did go to Milton.
Not when you said you were going to go.
Oh, why? Well,
you went that evening.
Oh, okay.
Around 7:30, 8 o'clock. Maybe you went to dinner out there or something.
We didn't go to dinner out there.
Who all went to dinner out there with you?
Me and Zach.
You and Zach. Okay. Where'd y'all eat at? We know that your aunt and uncle and Kyle own the farm there on Britt Road.
Right.
And it's showing that you're probably near that farm, or if not, at that farm. And you're there when this is the time when you're telling us that you're probably in Milton or headed towards Milton, because it's 12:10 in the afternoon. What were y'all doing out there at this farm? So we know y'all were there.
We picked up some stuff that Taylor had there that we that she had stored. Some kind of lockbox that she had.
Why would you not tell us that originally?
Because she asked me not to tell anyone ever.
That's not gonna
fly. I gotcha.
Okay.
Investigators also discovered that Ashley had been cashing forged checks and was caught skimming thousands of dollars from jukeboxes that her family rented to various bars. On October 9, 2017, officials got a search warrant for her family's farm on Britt Road, north of Pensacola. Within 2 hours of arriving, they stumbled upon a shallow grave covered with concrete. After opening it, they sadly found Taylor's remains, who had been shot and wrapped up in a hammock. They then got a search warrant for Ashley's home and found Taylor's passport and a gun with one bullet missing. She was then arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Leading up to Taylor's murder, she was trying to collect the $34,000 from Ashley, but was given multiple excuses why they couldn't go to the bank. Finally, Ashley agreed to take her on September 8, 2017, the day she disappeared. After Taylor left to go meet up with her, Cassandra strangely got a call from Ashley saying that she was taking Taylor to ride horses in East Milton instead of going to the bank. Cassandra was immediately concerned and sent Taylor a text, but didn't receive a reply until 7 p.m. The text she received said, "I'll call you later. I'm not angry with you, and I should have called, but I just need to think. I'm trying to get my life organized and on track." Investigators theorized that Taylor found out about the money missing, and it caused an argument, which eventually led to Ashley shooting her. What they probably didn't realize was that Ashley had been planning Taylor's murder for a while and was talking to a friend about it. That friend came forward and told investigators everything. She said that Ashley was planning to put drugs in Taylor's beer, but ultimately decided to shoot her instead. She also said that Ashley called Taylor a horrible person and said the world would be better off without her. They believe when Ashley took her to the farm that day, she shot her execution style. On October 23, 2019, Ashley was found guilty of premeditated first-degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 25 years. She also received another 7 years in prison for racketeering and fraud charges for stealing from her family's business. Daniel Ashton Walker Jr. was born in 1952 and grew up in Illinois. After high school, he enrolled in college, but quickly found himself on the road, traveling and working in several different states, eventually ending up in Europe. By the summer of 1974, he was back in the United States, working as a carpenter in Denver, Colorado, when family members of his in Santa Ana invited him to join them in California. Once there, he began working for a Costa Mesa sailboat manufacturer. His family said he was a very outgoing person who would always go out of his way to do a favor for people. Unfortunately, this would lead to Daniel's untimely demise. By the end of the summer, Daniel was ready to move on. He didn't like the crowds and congestion of Southern California and decided to head back to Colorado. On September 30th, 1974, 22-year-old Daniel was driving through Cajon Pass, north of San Bernardino, California, when he saw an 18-year-old man from Texas who needed a ride. This was not out of character because Daniel was known for picking up a hitchhiker. The man said he needed to go to Flagstaff, Arizona, and even though it was out of his way, Daniel agreed to take him. At about 1 a.m. on October 1st, after the passenger had already fallen asleep in the back, Daniel pulled his blue Volkswagen van over on the side of Interstate 40, about 62 miles west of Needles, so that he could get some rest as well. At about 6 or 6:30 a.m., while he and his passenger slept, someone came up to the van and shot Daniel with 4 blasts from a shotgun. His passenger heard the commotion and Daniel begging for his life before the shots were fired. When he heard the vehicle speed off, he looked out the window and saw a gold 1968 or 1969 Chevrolet or GMC model van fleeing the scene. He quickly flagged down 2 passing motorists, hoping to get some help for Daniel, who was dying from the gunshot wounds. A trucker also stopped and notified the police using his CB radio. The passenger described the killers as 2 white men in their early 20s. The motorists who were flagged down rushed Daniel to Needles Hospital, but unfortunately, he died from his injuries. The suspects only stole $80 from Daniel, but failed to take any other valuables. 33 miles west of the crime scene, the same men had flagged down a delivery man. The men had gotten their vehicle stuck in the sand, and the delivery driver pulled them out. He said that one of the men told him he was going back to Indiana to find his wife and children. They also said they just traded in another vehicle for their gold van and that they had a shotgun they were using to shoot down posts and sagebrush that they were using to get the van unstuck. After the delivery driver helped them get unstuck, they offered him money, but he declined and they all went on their way. The killer would elude police for decades until finally, in January 2024, one of the men was identified as serial murderer Thomas Eugene Creech. 73-year-old Creech was already in prison, serving his time on death row, and is actually Idaho's longest-serving death row inmate. Creech was arrested for the November 1974 double murder of 2 house painters, 40-year-old John Wayne Bradford and 34-year-old Edward Thomas Arnold. While on trial for the crime in 1975, he confessed to 42 other killings around the country. In the end, the real number was fewer than 14, and he was only convicted for 5 of those. In addition to Bradford and Arnold, his other victims were William Joseph Dean in Portland, Oregon, Vivian Grant Robinson in Sacramento, California, and fellow inmate David Dale Jensen. Since Creech is already on death row, it remains unclear if they will officially charge him in the case. Also, the other suspect has not been identified, but considering Creech's past, he is most likely the one who pulled the trigger that killed Daniel. Linda Ann O'Keefe was born on May 24, 1962, in Newport Beach, California, to parents Richard and Barbara. In 1973, 11-year-old Linda was still living in Newport Beach, was a member of the local youth center, and loved piano, painting, and crafts. She attended Lincoln Elementary School in Corona del Mar, which was close enough for her to ride her bicycle. However, on July 6, 1973, her piano teacher gave her a ride to summer school because she was going to walk home afterward. After her second class, she walked to a nearby store called Richard's Market and bought some bubblegum before returning to school in time for her third class. When summer school ended around lunch that day, she decided not to walk and instead went to the school secretary and asked to use the phone so she could call her mother and ask for a ride. However, the secretary told her she would have to wait. Instead of waiting, she went back to Richard's Market where she saw her friend Brenda. When they left the store, a turquoise van almost hit Brenda, but she was thankfully able to jump out of the way. However, the van stopped near Linda, who was further away. Brenda was too far away to see if the driver and Linda were talking. After the encounter, Linda went back to the school. She was finally allowed to use the phone, but her mother said she was busy with a sewing project and told her to walk home. Linda hated walking home, and when her mother refused to get her, she was mad and hung up and began crying. After walking out of the school, she went and sat down on the corner of Marguerite Drive and Inlet Drive. Sadly, she never made it home that day. When she failed to show up for lunch, her mother became worried and began calling around. Once her husband was home, they both went out looking for her. By 6:42 p.m., when there was still no sign of Linda, they reported her missing. Police began a massive search involving helicopters, but by the end of the day, there was still no sign of her. They finally had a break in the case when a little girl named Janine told officers that as she and her mother were driving, they saw Linda sitting on the corner with a turquoise van parked at the intersection. Janine's mother felt something wasn't right and stopped and parked just down a little ways from where Linda was. When the van left, she planned to write down the license plate, but it turned before reaching her. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to see if Linda was inside, but she did note that Linda was gone. Around this time, a woman who lived nearby said she heard a scream, but didn't think much of it until she found out that Linda was missing. The following day, a man who lived about a mile away from Linda's house took his 4-year-old son to a nearby lake to look for frogs. It was there he found Linda's body down in a ditch. At first, he thought she was sleeping, so he reached out and touched her hand. When she didn't respond, he quickly returned home and called the police. It was determined that Linda had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death. Unfortunately, with only a description of the suspect and his van, the case would go unsolved for the next 40-plus years. On July 7, 2018, the 45th anniversary of her murder, Newport Police Department announced they were going to partner with Parabon Nano Labs to try and solve the case using DNA. During this time, they also released photos of the clothes she was wearing and new sketches of the suspect. With the use of genetic genealogy and investigative leads, they were able to identify the killer as 73-year-old James Allen Neal, aka James Albert Layton Jr. Layton was born on July 28, 1946 in Chicago, Illinois, and was the middle child. His family moved to California in 1955, and 4 years later was the start of his long criminal career. His first charge was for burglary in August of 1959, and once again in October of 1959. After the second arrest, he was sent to juvie and paroled on July 1, 1961, but was placed back in juvie on October 16, 1962. He was once again paroled on August 27, 1963, but arrested once again in September 1964. This time, he was tried as an adult and sentenced to 9 months in the Orange County Jail for second-degree burglary. A year later, he was arrested for suspicion of burglary, but it was later dismissed. His parole officer said he had a difficult time forming relationships and holding down a job. After leaving California, he went to Ohio and then to Kentucky, where he trained in a dentist office. That wouldn't last, and he would end up in Denver in August of 1966. Once there, he got a job at a gas station, but was once again accused of stealing. Police said Layton was a chronic liar and would tell people he met that he was married and his wife was pregnant, and that was also his excuse for stealing. He was then arrested in Utah and then returned to Denver, where he was charged with larceny. He was paroled for that crime on July 14, 1971, 2 years before he abducted and murdered Linda. He was arrested again in September of 1973 in Florida, and then again in Denver in 1974 on a parole violation. He was once again paroled in 1975. At some point, while James was in Florida, he changed his name from Layton to Neal and his middle name from Albert to Allen. As for Linda's murder, investigators eventually tracked him down to Monument, Colorado, and arrested him in February 2019. He was then charged with Linda's murder, but he was also charged for a case in California dating back to 2002, where he was accused of lewd and lascivious acts. He pleaded not guilty to both charges, but would never go to trial because on May 25, 2020, he was rushed to the hospital with an undisclosed illness and died a few days later. Sadly, Linda's parents passed away before seeing the case solved. In 1991, 30-year-old Sherry Bridgewater was a mother of two living in an apartment in the 1000 block of Monroe Avenue in Las Vegas, Nevada. In May of 1991, a friend and a relative of Sherry's went by her apartment for a visit and shockingly found her body. Authorities were called and they determined she had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death. Unfortunately, with very little to go on, the case would go cold for decades. In 2013, advancements in technology allowed detectives to submit the sexual assault kit from the case for DNA examination. Through that examination, police were able to develop a suspect profile of the person believed to have killed Sherry. After submitting the profile to CODIS, Las Vegas Metro Police learned that Sherry's killer was also connected to a second unsolved murder in Westminster, Colorado. 20-year-old Terry Becker was last seen on December 4, 1975, while hitchhiking to see her boyfriend in Brighton, Colorado. Her family described her as a free spirit who enjoyed living life on the edge. 2 days later, two passing motorists discovered Terry's body in an agricultural field in the area of 100th Avenue and Lowell Boulevard in Westminster, about 10 miles north of Denver, along with her clothes and personal items. She had tragically been sexually assaulted and strangled to death before being left in a field. She was remembered as being able to hold a conversation with anyone and enjoying painting and listening to music. It was determined that the same person had killed both Sherry and Terry, but it would be another decade before they could figure out who it was. Investigators decided to submit the case to Parabon Nano Labs and then to Solves by DNA in Denver, Colorado in 2018 for forensic genealogy. 5 years later, the suspect was identified as career criminal Thomas Martin Elliott. Westminster police said it took so long because tracing Thomas's genetic DNA was a challenge, as his parents had divorced and he was adopted by his stepfather, whose last name he used. Investigators were able to place Thomas in Colorado at the time of Terry's murder and in Las Vegas at the time of Sherry's murder. He was arrested in Colorado for a burglary charge around the time of Terry's murder. He was then taken to Carson City, where he served his time. Shortly after he was released in 1981, he committed a sexual assault on a 13-year-old girl in Carson City and was once again arrested and remained in prison until he was paroled in 1991. After being released, he murdered Sherry. 6 months later, he took his own life. To be certain he was Sherry's killer, his body was exhumed in October 2023, and DNA was collected from tissue and bone samples. Those samples were then confirmed to be a match from both homicides, officially solving Terry's case after 48 years and Sherry's case after 32 years. Police later added that Thomas possibly met Sherry at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Unfortunately, Sherry's parents died before Thomas was identified. However, police notified both of her adult sons and brought some long-awaited closure to her family. On September 9, 1985, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office received a call about a body in the 1100 block of North Market Street in the Springfield neighborhood of Jacksonville, Florida. The victim was identified as 38-year-old Annie Mae Ernest, and the cause of death was ruled a homicide. The last person to see Annie alive was 39-year-old Robert Vance, who openly admitted to being with her on the night of the murder. He then agreed to come in for questioning and to take a polygraph, but failed to show up. When investigators went to his apartment, they found it empty and abandoned. At some point, they learned that Robert Vance was an alias and that his real name was Robert Richard Van Pelt. After Annie's murder, Pelt fled to Tampa and began using the name John Leroy Harris. Unfortunately, they were unable to track him down, and the case would go unsolved for the next 38 years. In July of 2023, a family member of Annie's contacted cold case detectives and requested an update on her case. This got the wheels turning in the case, and they were finally able to find out what happened to Pelt. Investigators said they used modern technology and databases to discover that after he fled to Tampa, he was accused of shooting a woman in 1988. The victim thankfully survived, but before he could be brought to justice, he took his own life. They then used fingerprint analysis to determine that Robert Vance, John Leroy Harris, and Robert Richard Van Pelt were all the same person. Investigators are certain that Pelt murdered Annie, and if he were alive today, he would be charged in her case. Unfortunately, there are no details about Annie's life, nor is there a photo of Pelt. Thanks for joining me today on Southern Girl Crime Stories. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, location of murders, and more. As always, your support is very much appreciated, and I look forward to seeing y'all next time.